I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The whole point of this episode is, right, we're going into 2021. I'd noticed that 2020 was just being framed as this dumpster fire that the new year was going to solve. And as we talked in the last episode, people has had and have this sort of escape fantasy about what 2021 could be. And what I wanted to do was not like this year in review, 2020, something like that. I wanted to get smart, optimistic, philosophical people who know how to navigate a dumpster fire and give you real world tips to do so,
right?
You know, something a little more helpful, a guidebook, a spiritual guide, as it were. So I thought of three people from unique circumstances who I thought could help guide us through this. We got Dr. Neil, we got Roger Harvey, and we have Dr. Judith Kaufman, my aunt, who should school us. We haven't gotten to that one yet, but I thought it would be a fun mix up, right? To just not have 90 minutes about you talking about guitar tone with somebody and let's try
and
you to
talking sports
and me talking sports, some bullshit. Yeah. Like what are the things that, that you learned from this year? Because I know I did. I had some crazy moments this year where everything got stripped back, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Everything you think is important, it's not important all of a sudden. And then the things that you knew were important the whole time, you all of a sudden value more. And I think a lot of people, once you start looking back on this year, are going to find a lot of advances in their life, in their own philosophies and how they adapt to the world, how they see their family, their jobs. You know, it's so much to unpack that I thought it would be good to start it on a positive note.
Absolutely.
And bring in some optimists and bring in some spirit guides, as it were. I've always found this with myself. A lot of people look to some places that I haven't been able to look, you know, like I'm not going to turn on the TV and feel something with like Oprah Winfrey or feel something with a politician or even feel something with an athlete, you know, like as much as I love sports, that is not a place where I go for my spiritual guidance.
Right.
And I find people who have had a wealth of experience that I know and that I respect who came out on the other side. Those are the people I really listen to. You know what I mean? Cause it's the people who, you know, they say like ignorance is bliss. Like some people just had a certain type of life where they may not be able to understand, or at least give it to somebody else as far as guidance is concerned. And let's take this for example. I always respected somebody who was straight edge after really being into drinking and drugs more than someone who just decided to be straight edge.
Right.
Because I was like, you're making a decision right now.
Yeah, you're making a big change. The change that can be scary sometimes.
Yeah, and you're making a change. Exactly. You have that wherewithal to change your focus and change the fork in the road. And in the same way, I know it shouldn't be viewed as like that. And I don't want to belittle stories that haven't had struggle, but people who have had struggle and been through a lot of things and seen a lot of things and still come out this positive and still come out trying to find the silver lining and trying to find optimism. Those are people I not only want to be around, I want to know what they're doing. You know, mm-hmm. I want to know how you're framing your thinking, how you're framing your day. Cause some of it is not even just philosophical. Some of it is, you know, when we just did the episode with Jeff Rosenstock and Chris a couple months ago, how both of them wake up in the morning and don't look at their phone for the first couple hours.
Yeah.
You know, even some small actual physical tool you can use these days, take an hour in the morning, don't look at your phone, you know, look at the world, talk to your people, breathe, think, you know, all these different ways that people can get through the day. And that's what I wanted to do with this episode. Next week, we'll get back to someone talking about songwriting or guitar tones or pushing knobs and, you know, all the things that you're here for.
Exploding tour buses.
What do you use? You wake up in the morning and you're feeling a little dreadful about what's happening. What's something that you do?
I am caffeine addict, although just in the morning, I really enjoy a nice strong cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And breathing, I usually do some simple like breathing exercises. Just it's very calming and puts you back in control and perspective.
Yeah.
But yeah, the morning ritual is mainly coffee, and I usually try to go out. I have a balcony with a really great view, so you should try to. I go out there in the morning and just kind of like greet the world sort of mentally.
And let me ask you this question. Say you're midday, things are piling on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's bad. Things are bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the neighborhood's packed, something happened at school. Some kid needs help. You know, your chain on your bike broke. You know, like whatever. Like some collection of shit. What's something in your infinite age and wisdom? What's something that you like literally tell yourself? Like, is there anything you can tell yourself? Like, that is not as important, that you need to calm down. Like, is there anything you got in the toolbox for that?
These days, when I start to lose it, unfortunately, it's generally all around one particular 9-year-old who I love dearly, but who is just literally like, he is Dennis the Menace. He is a cartoon character of a 9-year-old boy. I mean... he'll take as much as he can and you can't turn your back on him. But at the same time, he's the most loving kid. And so when he's unbearable, I have to just remind myself that he's not a fully functional grown human. And I need to make sure that that path completes itself with the least amount of damage. And
and then in fact,
like what he's doing at the end of the day, that's so irritating is really like, it's what he is, you know, he's like this other creature that is totally different than anybody else in this household, but not totally different than probably what I was like at that age. So I just have to, and I've tried to do this with other people too, is just embrace the fact that this is what everybody is. And without diversity, without everybody being different, it would suck.
Well, that's a good simple one you get from kids, right? It's just this you no longer can even begin to start putting people in a box anymore.
Right.
Or having that expectation for what you want someone to be. Or at least in the very least, you understand that how the fuck is anyone else supposed to even know what the fuck you want them to be and why should they do it?
Right.
You know, like even just some of those simple contexts, like, and maybe I think that's something that drives people mad. You know, my father just always stresses the fact that the anger almost all of the time is, you know, due to a lack of control.
Yeah.
And, you know, so many people bash their heads against the wall through their whole life, essentially trying to sort of micromanage other people and, you know, the small ways that they treat you or the small ways that they see the world. Yeah. Letting that go is, that's probably a good one.
So who do we have? Who do we have first on this adventure we're about to embark on?
So first we got Dr. Neil Keechee, old friend, sage wisdom, tended bar at the famous Maxwell's for like a decade. That's actually where I got to know him, because Alex from Gaslight Anthem had moved into an apartment almost across the street from Maxwell's, which turned Maxwell's into I go to shows here every once in a while to we drink here now. And Neil was a bartender there. And I remember even Alex saying like, yo, you got to hang with this guy, Neil, like at the bar, like you guys would hit it off,
all right,
you know? And sure enough, you know, I went there to drink. He created a shot there called the Pickleback, where you drink a shot of whiskey and take a shot of pickle juice right.
Wait,
after.
Did he actually invent that?
He was the first one I saw do it. I'm sure it was a thing before that, but
okay.
He invented it in my, okay. in my narrative. Okay.
We'll let him have it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, Maxwell's had great food and we go there and chill, and you know, that's how I got to know him really well. And, you know, he's been on a path all these years of, you know, building a family and educating himself, and just more and more as the years go on, he's become a true keeper of sage wisdom. And the fact that like, trust me, if you saw this guy with his girls, you're like, all right, dad goals, you know, like he's just got it on lock.
Wow.
You see him like riding around. He lives down by the beach and, you know, he'll be riding a bike with all three girls and a bucket in the back.
Oh, you know, he's like super dad.
Super fucking dad, you know?
Oh, like, okay.
Yeah. So one of those, true mentor, you know, like if I was going to call somebody, be like, hey, my kid is doing this and this, like he'd be one of my first, you know?
Okay.
Neil, very accomplished, also big Rutgers basketball fan. We used to go to games together. Not to talk about too much sports, but this is the first time in like 100 years that Rutgers basketball is ranked nationally, and the first time we can't go to any games to root for them. Mm. Poor us. It's going off track! Dr. Neil.
Hi, Benny. How are you?
What's up, buddy?
Not much, man.
I can't believe I'm talking to you in this context.
This is, yeah.
How strange. But we've wanted to do this for a while, haven't we? Something
we have.
Like this.
I feel like many of our phone conversations could be their own podcast.
Exactly.
Many of our podcasts are just therapy for Benny. So just so you know.
This is a hot topic, Neil. Let's just dig right into it. Okay? So I texted Brad this weekend with a couple emotional texts. You know what I mean? A little over the top.
Right.
And he gave me nothing back. No answer. Cold cocked me.
A thumbs up.
Nothing. And I had to, like, beginning of this week, I'm like, listen, we just did this Jimmy Eat World interview, and if there's anything we learned, this is all about communication, you know? Right. And I'm like, listen, we're in an artistic partnership together. I'm going to get a little emo every once in a while. I need to get these things out. And you got to answer me. And I know he's doing that like white Irish guy IPA thing where he thinks I went like a little too far and you just have to draw this line in the sand with the guy. You're like, listen, I just produced the podcast. I can't go this deep. You know, I know it's exactly what happened. I see it play out and I reject it. And I reject it because 2021 is not about that, Brad and Neil.
Betty, can you just, I mean, without divulging too much, can you just give me like a snippet of like some key words that were in the text that you sent Brad? That
in my emotional text?
Yeah.
Oh, I can read it to you.
No.
I don't need that.
Neil knows me well enough.
I can substitute for the names.
Let's just say it was overarching insecurity. about what I'm doing and its quality and its place in the world. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of older white guys from rock and roll doing podcasts, talking to other old white guys from rock and roll, you know?
Right.
And I gotta find my place in this thing that feels good, because on a week-to-week basis, I need to feel good about what I'm doing, or else I don't want to do it, you know? That's the way I operate.
Well, speaking of old white guys, I'm looking forward to sharing with you my New Year's Eve story. Cause I like when you sent me the email and I was like, you know, like I'm not like a huge, like, you know, I have my drinks and stuff, but I don't go into one New Year the same way leaving an old. So I don't think I've ever been super hammered or crazy. But then I thought of one and I was like, oh yeah, I think this. So we'll say that or whatever.
Let's jump in. Let's hear it.
Yeah,
man.
Jump in. This is part of it. For a little pre-context here, I did ask everybody who's coming on today for their wackiest or funniest New Year's Eve story of all time, going off what Brad and I did in the last episode. So that's the context. And Neil said he had a doozy for us. Apparently, dealing with an annoying white guy.
Yeah, or multiple annoying white guys. So just some context and backstory. So I worked at at Maxwell's in Hoboken for 10 years of my life, from 2004 to like when it closed.
Oh, right.
And its original incarnation. I met my wife there. It was like that, and I'm still very good friends with the old owner. So it's like
very cool.
when the memoir of my life never gets written, that chapter will like take a huge like chunk of the book, because sure. So many things came out of that. So you know, and I was like, you know, I bartend bar back, work the door, you know, I guess I'm Indian, so instead of the jack of all trades, I guess I was a Patel of all trades, for lack of you know. And so it was, and this isn't necessarily, it's not a, and one caveat, it's not a New Year's Eve story. It's a December 30th story. It's the closest thing I got, since I'm not that much of a, you know, crazy, like, you know, bashing things on, I guess, if that's what people do on New Year's.
Listen, if Hoboken, New Year's Eve starts like December 22nd.
Right. So, I think it was either 2010 or 2011, and Guided by Voices was playing a sold out show. Cool. At Maxwell's. I think the following night they were at Irving Plaza, and on their rider, they had requested a bucket on stage to piss in.
Piss bucket. Okay.
A piss bucket.
I see they've played Maxwell's before. So,
and if you know, if you're unfamiliar with the layout of Maxwell's, like, the men's bathroom is right by the front door. It's like one stall, one urinal. And if you're a performer, you got to wade through like 200, 250 people,
sure,
you know, and fans like touching you. Not, you know, not me, but I've seen it to like artists, you know, like, mm-hmm. You know, so they asked for a piss bucket, and then they played a great show. It was awesome. And then at the end of the night, the owner, Todd, comes up to me and looks at me, and he and I are very close. We have a very good relationship. He just looks at me and he's like, "Neil, there's a piss bucket on stage." And I'm like, we all knew, like everybody that worked, everybody knew that those dudes, and like they had a huge rider and they were drinking a lot, and everyone knew, like, oh my God, Guided by Voices is like, are pissing in a bucket during their performance. Because they don't want to walk through the crowd and like use, you know, the normal people bathroom, right?
Wait, all right. Just for myself here, for context, like, are they in the front of the stage, bareballing it to the crowd? Did they stick it in like the back corner?
It was off to the side, but you can periodically what you look like they would have their backs turned and like they're peeing.
Okay,
and so. So like it's the end of the night and I'm like cleaning up stuff and the owner comes up to me and he's like there's a piss bucket on stage. I'm like, I'm just looking at him and I know where this is going, but I'm just like, he's like, and I'm like, yeah. He's like, it's got to get off stage. And I'm like, all right. And then he looks at me and he's like, either you do it or Rafi does it. And now keep in mind, Rafi was like one of the old school kitchen dudes. He's like 15 years older than me, and I had like super, super respect for him. And no way, just out of sheer principle, am I gonna like go like make Raffy do it? You know, like no way, right?
Sure.
So I just look, and I'm like, all right, like, and so, so whoever's listening, or maybe you, this is my first experience dealing with a piss bucket. So I'm like walking back there, and I'm like, where do I grab it from? I don't know. Like, I feel like in most situations, like, you know, but this, I was like,
yeah, so I'm staring, and then a true first, right. No contact.
And that, and now like other people I work with, they're like, what are you going to do? You know, and not only that, it's like, it's cold outside and snowing, and I have to like get it off the stage. So I pick it up by like the handle.
Oh, and it's dangerous, like, right off.
And it's like, and it's like what, 4 or 5, like, old white guy's pee that I'm and so I like, you know, like when you carry something really heavy and your legs, you kind of like waddle a little bit because and so I waddle, like I have someone hold the door open for me because a less like break in the movement produce less, like, you know. And then we get out there, and there's like 5 of us on the sidewalk. Like,
oh my god!
And now I'm like, I can't dump it on the sidewalk.
Yeah, like kids, that's a high traffic area around Maxwell's. I was just thinking, there's no alleys there.
Yeah, and like, you know, and like, I like to think again, I have some principles. I'm like, I'm not going to dump it where some like grandma or some like mom pushing a stroller is going to roll.
Sure.
Like through like yellow snow, you know.
What is this? Guided by voices, piss.
It smells as good as their music. No, you know what? That came out wrong.
That's okay.
I like their music. I like their music. That came out wrong. So I, you know, I like by that time, like we, I don't remember how, but I lifted up again, and I just kind of like kept like on a count of 3, like swung it and then launched it into the street.
Wow.
And
what, you let go of the bucket?
I let go of the bucket and then jump back to avoid any type of like,
okay.
Okay.
And it dropped on 11th Street. It freaking, you know, like all came, I had to go over and I kicked it over a couple of times to make sure there wasn't anything left like in it. And then I picked up this empty bucket at like 31, 32 years of age, going like, what am I doing with my life?
This is it. This is the culmination. Yeah.
And that is like, when anyone asks me like a New Year's story, I'm like, last night I thought of it. I'm like, well, it's a December 30th story. And that's the close it's going to get.
Was that actually the night? Like, did you have like an aha moment holding the piss bucket where you were like, all right, back to school. Dr. Neil is coming in the future. Like, I can't take it.
It was the, like, I'm getting too old for this shit moment.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was cool. And now, like, look, you know, what is it? Like 10 years later, I'm telling you the story.
I mean, this is to bring it. So now you are an esteemed professor.
Thank you. I think you're too kind, and you're hyping me up a little bit. But
we'll keep it low. So next semester, someone doesn't come in and go like, "Huh, piss bucket, huh?"
Yeah. Right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
But you're very highly rated on college websites, which I didn't know existed. Now, Brad, do you know that there are websites where like ratemyprofessor.com?
I did not know that. I knew you could do schools, but not, I didn't know you could actually dig into the actual.
So I'm like, oh my personnel. God, like I'm looking into Neil here, but luckily for him, he's a very highly rated professor.
I always say that they just don't know any better, but it's, you know, it's nice to, at least they're not trashing me. Not yet anyway. That's good.
I mean, all right. So let's get into this a little bit. So I you know, right off the bat, you deal with like addressing large groups of people, making these people, not making them, but presenting information and doing it in a live context. You mm-hmm. once told me about the power of a live show.
Right.
And I think I was the same. I probably gave you the same kind of text I gave to Brad, being insecure about my musical life rather than my podcast life. And you were telling me that, you know, the power of a live show and a group of people that can be positively directed can alter the world in an actual tangible way.
Right.
Now,
I remember that. I remember that.
I think that's the beginning of Almost Famous, you're quoting.
Listen, I bought it. Doesn't matter. I bought it. William Miller or not. I bought it hook, line, and sinker. But now it's gone. And I wonder, you know, especially now for someone like you too, who deals in that context, like, where does that void fill from concerts, from group prayer and meditation, group education? Like, do you think that part of the world is just voided right now? And where are people bringing that back from?
So, you know, we, and to your question, like, this relates all under the guise of our, you know, current,
yeah,
so cultural, social, national, global climate as it has been for the last 10 months, right? Yeah, you know, like, so as an educator, you know, I have this great opportunity to work with college students, and so we, you know, when things happened in March, like, everything shifted online. But what I'm in an interesting position because I'm a father of three girls.
Right. Yeah.
8, 6, and 4. And so what I noticed for me personally was, like, you know, my education, my courses and my classes went on, you know, just in a different format. And I still brought the same type of educational instruction and enrichment experience to the class. But what I noticed, though, is, like, a lot of my energy and focus, to your question, like, I turned it on my kids in a very positive way, because,
right,
like,
right,
because at the end of the day, like, and I need to preface this, like, outside of, you know, putting aside as if we can at all, like, the mounting death toll and the complete destruction of our economy, the arts, and, like, mom and pop shops. Right.
Yeah. Right.
Like I personally used this as an opportunity to channel what I have done in the classroom for almost 18 years now, and put it to my kids.
Right.
And it's like the one reference. Do you remember that movie, Life is Beautiful?
Yeah.
With now, obviously, in no way, shape, or form am I comparing the events of the Holocaust and a global pandemic is, like, on the same level. But if you remember the father Guido, like, well, you say, buongiorno, principessa, like that, you know? But, like, his whole thing, like, you know, the Nazis came in and took him and his kid, and he, like, created this environment for his kid, yeah, where, like, where it was this game.
Right, right.
And so I remember, like, it was, like, March, and, you know, to be fair, like, I'm an eternal optimist by nature.
It's true.
And so, you know, and my wife considers her more of a realist, but she always says that I can find good in a piece of shit, right? but at the same time, I have, like, I'm not an idiot. Like,
no, yeah,
a piece of shit is a piece of shit, but if there's, yeah, good in it, I'll try to find it. But, you know, our focus became, like, on the, you know, every parent, you know, and, like, again, whoever's listening to this, like, this is a perspective of a 42-year-old father of three, right? So if, like, if there's some 22-year-old kid out there, like, what is this guy talking
Thanks
about?
A lot, pal, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Fast forward. but the one thing, like, I remember, like, in the middle of March, I was talking to my wife Megan, and I'm like, yo, this is gonna be going on for a little bit. And she's a super social butterfly. And I think it took her some time to, like, acknowledge that. And for me, I'm like, listen, like whatever we create from this point on going forward is what our children will respond and reflect and react accordingly.
Right. Sure.
And so, you know, we sat them down. We talked to them like adults. We explained to them about, like, hey, listen, like, you can't go to school because we're trying to protect the grandparents, and we're trying to make sure the hospitals don't overflow. And we put it in we broke it down in ways where they could, the best way an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old could understand.
Sure.
And so again, going back to your question, like, how do I fill that void? So like, I took it as an opportunity where I'm like, never again will I have this moment to teach my kids. Mm. Right. So not only was I like college instructor via online during the day, but I also would pause and then become elementary school teacher to my kids.
Right.
And I would get up early and I would like make them these like big breakfasts, right? And like these smoothies and the goal was to make it this like quarantine super fun. So when they rolled out of it, they were like, yo, that wasn't that bad. Like, can you, one thing I did was I would pick a different 80s song during the week and blast it to wake them up.
Okay.
So like, imagine
like different tune a week.
Yeah. So like one week it was St. Elmo's Fire.
Oh, thank goodness.
So imagine like being like an 8 or 6 year old or 4 year old and around 7:15, all of a sudden hearing. Yeah. And I'm like, everybody up, you know? Listen,
kids have no respect for the saxophone in rock and roll anymore. You know? I appreciate it.
So the long, the short answer or long answer to your question was like the energy that I put into the classroom in front of my college students. When March hit and quarantine hit and the stay at home order hit, I was like, all right, like let's take like now all this now get like I do it either way, but like when they're home from school, but now I'm like, all right, we're together, and right. Now all that energy gets transferred onto them, and I'm in a good place, like a. I feel like I'm in a fortunate situation where I love my wife and kids, but I really love hanging out with them. Mm. And so it was easy for us.
Right. In that way.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that totally answers how you filled the void. So when I would play a concert, right. And you would say there was this connection of, you know, spirits and emotions and like, some sort of philosophical move towards the same goal that connected us in a strange way. So that's like a tangible thing that goes out into the world via a concert or via group prayers or, you know, meditations, things like that.
Right.
Where did that go in the world? And what actually provides that connection? Is it just the mental knowledge that you're connected with someone, which would mean Zoom is doing a perfectly good job filling that void? Or is there something about being in the same place that actually fills that void in a different kind of way?
Well, so that's, you know, what's interesting about that is I've always like, not only, you know, as we discuss like these, be it concerts, be it, religious services, leave you with this, like, it almost gives you like emotional, mental fuel. Right.
Right.
And to your question, like, where did it go? Like, I feel like it also, at least over the course in my own, you know, personal and unprofessional opinion, like, I felt like it was a moment, where every single individual in essence needed to reassess and not use maybe these large group gatherings, these concerts, these prayer services as a way to, how can I put this? Like, fill a void, right?
Right. Yeah, sure.
And instead it's like, it really forced a lot of people to look inward, to reflect and like, and ask themselves what now when the things that I'm so used to and I don't want to say it's a crutch, because I don't believe that people use, you know, these group gatherings as a crutch, but in a way it helps us deflect and ignore some of the maybe more important and pressing issues in our lives.
Right, sure.
And I felt like it was an opportunity for all of us as individuals, again, with the understanding that, you know, like I'm thankful every day that, you know, we personally didn't experience any loss. And for the most part, economically, we were okay, right? Mm-hmm. But I think like, I feel like it forced, not having that as a go-to for a lot of people, I feel like forced them to reevaluate individually their place in life, their goals, what they want to do, what they haven't done, and where they're at.
Right.
So I don't know, I can't, because like, I personally didn't, miss going to shows because I was like more focused on nurturing and growing the mental and emotional health of my kids, right?
Yeah, sure.
So I think it was a moment and in time these last few months where I think it's the journey, as opposed to sharing it with others, was more of like an inward personal journey of everyone, mm-hmm. like a reassessing and reevaluating their own position in life.
Yeah, totally. Maybe transcendental meditation had a big year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for yourself, you know, as you stated yourself, you can find the hopefulness in anything, a pretty optimistic character. I can vouch and speak to that as well. So what are some actual daily tools or philosophies or resources that you could offer to someone in like the year ahead to try to, you know, use you as a spirit animal?
Well, you know, I think this is what I noticed a lot in like watching all those like crazy New Year's Eve countdowns, like
the fitness, the Planet Fitness New Year's. Jesus Christ, that was strange.
Yeah. Those were so bizarre, all of them.
Yeah, they were really bizarre.
But the one common theme was like everybody, if like 99% of like the conversations and comments were about like setting 2020 on fire and like giving it the finger and rightfully so. There was like so much shit that went down that like I also have to believe that there are moments that we can all take from this and say like, but there was some, at least from an individual standpoint, like what was the good that came out of it for me?
Yeah.
Right. Again, as a disclaimer, understanding that lots of loss of life and businesses and the economy just,
sure.
You know, I have groups of friends who work in the financial district who are like, you know what? I would leave the house at 6, come back home at 8 and not see my kids until the weekends. And all of a sudden they have a newfound connection and relationship with their children, you know,
right.
People who are like, man, I used to commute all the time. Now I'm working from home and it's like, and it's great. Like just like the little things. So like, I feel like as much of a dumpster fire 2020 was, I think like to your question about tools and maybe not a grandiose philosophy, but more like, you know, I have to believe that at least for the individual, that there was some good that came out that we can use and grow from.
Okay.
And maybe seek inspiration from like I've witnessed firsthand educators who on the fly just create, like specifically public school teachers and like my kids' teachers in particular, who on the fly like kept doing what they're doing as a labor of love, you know?
Right.
And like you saw the differentiation between anyone in any field who like was doing it because it's a labor of love versus doing it because like they just had to, or did, you know, or like, or they have nothing else to do, you know?
Sure.
And so I think that was like something, and I hope that like in the same way that we as like a species, like responded and reacted creatively to a pandemic, that maybe we carry over that same creativity into like our evolution as like humans and the next phase of humanity, you know?
Totally. Yeah, and I noticed, and you know, I was trying to bring some hopefulness into this, so I was looking for the best things that happened in education the last year. The list was thin, but I did find at least one, like the University of California began to move an end to the use of the SAT and ACT in its admission requirements.
Oh yeah, think about it, like there's no, like I don't want to say no way, but I can't see them all of a sudden saying like, all right, now we're instituting it back.
Right, 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 right. So, maybe it is like leveling things out a bit. It's like, so how much of that though to you is, you know, as someone who decides to go inside themselves fairly often, and I feel like it's one of the powers of prayer or meditation or anything, it's just this sort of idea that you need to reflect with your own sense of death and morbidness every single day, basically. Now, like, where does that move ahead? Do you think that people have a different understanding about their own life, their own death, like a little bit more of a nurturing for the minutes and the time that they maybe previously didn't have?
You know, in addition to like class-based discussions in my courses, like one of the things I emphasize in our conversations and assignments is like the art of reflecting, right?
Right.
And I think as a society, as a culture, as an American culture, that's something that we don't do a lot of. I think a lot of the times, again, personal, unprofessional opinion, like the foot is on the gas pedal.
Yeah.
And we're in tunnel vision, blinders on, and it's full speed ahead. And very rarely do we stop to reflect not only on our thoughts, but our actions and the repercussions of our actions.
Sure.
And like there's this like Buddhist this tenet in Buddhist philosophy called like dependent origination, mm-hmm. which pretty much argues like the simple bare bones about it. It's like that everything, like there are reverberating effects of everything that we do and everything that we say.
Right.
So like if you drop a pebble in a lake, right, like you're going to see that pebble, you drop a pebble in the middle of the lake, like the little waves are going to splash and it's going to spread out all over to the various sides of the lake. And that's like, in essence, like our action, our word, like how it spreads and into ways that we know and don't know. And I feel mm-hmm. like in a individualistic, capitalistic society that we live in, I feel like instead of looking at the pebble being dropped into a lake and its effects to everyone around you, we're more like the kid doing a cannonball off the diving board.
Yeah. right.
Where you just do the cannonball and it's like, yeah. I did the cannonball. Whoa, awesome. You know? And so, you know, it will be interesting going forward to see what the last 9-10 months has done to us as a, you know, speaking strictly as an American culture, what is done in terms of us taking a pause and reflecting on like our actions, what's important to us and changes, both, you know, positive changes we can make in our lives.
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, you talk about that and I mean, the cannonball reference is perfect. That's exactly what you do. See how much water I can dump out of this thing. Fucker! You know, it's totally the way we operate.
But also, like, and going back to what you said earlier about the live music, like, in essence, like, you know, as live musicians and like whoever goes to an experience at a show, like that reverberation carries with like people for days, for weeks, for months, you know?
Right.
And it's like, so if the musicians on stage are that rock, or even maybe that kid doing the cannonball, but really the actions and the energy and that flow spreads far and wide. And so both in ways seen and unseen.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder at this point is the end of the ripple an unseen thing? Is it a philosophical thing? Because it seems to me that most people caught in the moment when the rock is thrown or the cannonball enters the pool, you know, they seem to double down and jump back in their own hole before the ripple even has a chance to get out to the side. And that's where I wonder sometimes if the people actually inside of it are a lost cause and all of the efforts are for like the people who will feel the ripple further out, which is probably the next generation.
Right. You know, I thought about something similar in it. So if I don't think I'll be getting too much on a tangent, but I think like culturally speaking, I think what you see a lot of what you're describing is like when people post or when people tweet, right?
Right.
Because that same pebble, that same cannonball can also be found in like any words or posts that individuals put up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so like when you ask like for me like what I hope for in 2021, you know, philosophically and tools, you know, I think I shared my thoughts on it, but also like I would love to see like more technological literacy, and not in a way where you need to code or build a startup, right?
Right.
But more like, if like ridding of like, if like social media companies and just for a social experiment, like got rid of the comment section.
Yeah.
Number one. And number two, got rid of like the edit and delete button. And then that way, like whatever you post, whatever you tweet, whatever you say, that becomes a digital tattoo.
Right.
And that way, like if you think it, you feel it, you tweet it, you send it, and that is like, and you mean it, and that's there forever. Right.
It's on wax.
And going back to our idea about reflect, and I hope like without those tools to like delete and edit, then it would give people pause and it would give people a sense of reflection. Like, do I really want this as a digital tattoo on me?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
And that way you eliminate like the, oh, I accidentally, I got hacked or I didn't mean that, or, you know, and I feel like
drunk.
Right. Or the proverbial follow-up tweet of like, I apologize for my insensitivity
to anyone who I may have offended. Yeah.
So I think that ties into this idea of like reflection, and I think in 2019 and prior, as a culture, I don't think we did a lot of that. And I'm interested to see as a result of 2020 if it will lead more people to do that.
Yeah. No, I think you're 100% right. I think we're going in a direction literally like 25, 50 years from now. I think they're going to look at us and be like, oh my God, they just gave you guys those things. Like, really? You just, oh my goodness. Like, that must have been fucked up. You know, like, it's not going to age well. So all that being said, if you could not even recommend, let's be more forceful about it. If you could put into the hands of every American one book, film, or podcast for next year, what do you think would be the most vital or most helpful?
Oh, wow. Book, film, or podcast.
I'm just putting podcasts into this space to legitimize myself here, you know.
I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. I'm reading a book. Why not? I'm looking. I got one. Actually, I have one that I feel very confident with.
Okay.
And I'll give you two. And one that like I'm saying I'm reading right now that I really like. But if it ends up like the end of it, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe that. That's my disclaimer. I feel like A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that is because I feel like the history classes that you wanted, or at least I wanted as a high school student, and as a college student, is all in that book.
Sure.
And all it is, it's like, it's not, and I mean, it's a very, gives you a different perspective on the various historical events in our time.
Yeah, if you come away after chapter one still digging Christopher Columbus, that's a moral decision.
Currently reading is called The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck.
Okay.
And Benny, you'll appreciate this because I was rereading Pat Riley's book from the early 90s.
Okay.
And in it, he cites this like a passage from this book, and the subtitle. So it's called The Road Less Traveled: A New Psychology of Love, Traditional Values, and Spiritual Growth.
Wow.
He died in 2005. I'm looking at the back right now, about halfway through. So far, there's nothing like where he's not like some sort of crazy lunatic or like right. I did a quick Google search on him and he seemed like during his time, he seemed to be pretty, you know, I don't know much about him yet, but, so in Pat Riley's book, there was a passage from it. And I'm like, oh, let me check it out. And so, so far it's a pretty good read.
Awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, Neil, thanks for doing this.
Thank you both for the opportunity and and, you know, keep doing what you're doing. Benny, when at some point I'd love to have that conversation with you about about what you texted Brad about, and maybe we can
we'll unpack it. Dr. Keechee.
I want to move to the Jersey Shore and hang out with Neil.
I know. Dr. Neil.
I want him to be my friend.
Yeah, he's a very inspiring human, very fun to be around. Has never even remotely disturbed me at all.
What's wrong with him?
I know, he's just always been great. Waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah, seriously. You know? What's going on? Who's he burying out there in the woods of New Jersey?
Yeah. Nah, such a good guy, man. And also connected to the world. Also the brother of the original Bouncing Souls drummer. So,
okay. I didn't know that. Ciao.
Yeah, born and raised punk rocker as well. He's got this mixture of philosopher, alternative kid, you know, like, you know, son of an immigrant. Like, there's all this stuff going on. With Neil, it just makes him a very complex individual and definitely one of my true spirit animals. That's a fact.
Nice.
I'm assuming that you went to Maxwell's a bunch.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, like, you know, that's there's a lot of cred there. I mean, Maxwell's is, you know, that's like the CBGBs of certain scenes. I wouldn't say Hoboken, but like, you know, I guess it is the CBs of Hoboken, but like it's got its own vibe. And, you know, if you're going to hang out and drink beer someplace, that's a good place to do it, dude.
Yeah. I got to say, it's probably one of the closest things Jersey ever had to a CBGBs type thing, as far as, you know, how long it existed and how many different bands stepped through there.
And I remembered the bathroom situation.
Oh,
but nightmare. And I remember like being just generally, well, just getting on stage was like when it was a packed house, it was impossible to get up on stage because there's no backstage.
Yeah.
There's no way to get to the stage except through the crowd.
No, it's definitely one of those venues that you quickly learn to like, you play that venue in a different way, you know?
Yeah, you get a piss bucket, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's where, when he first told that story about the piss bucket, I'm like, oh, well, they've played there before.
Yeah, exactly.
Which means he's been stuck on stage needing to piss before. So obviously it's New Year's, we're going for it. Bring in the piss bucket. I mean, it's not the worst idea, but to paint anybody a picture, I mean, Maxwell's was in a very like, you know, a very urban area. It's in the middle of North Hoboken. And one thing that North Jersey does not have, and even New York City doesn't have, that's misrepresented in movies and stuff, we don't have alleys.
Yeah, true that.
There's no alleyways, you know? So there's nowhere nice to take a piss. Even if you leave the venue to go take a piss, you're still pissing in front of like either four yuppies or like three 16-year-old Puerto Rican kids over there. Like, someone's watching you piss. So that was my first thought, is like, where did you even dump the bucket? You know?
Yeah. Like, but didn't Maxwell's have, like, Maxwell's had used to feed you, right? They had good food there.
Great food.
Yeah. I thought
another part of the weird balance in playing there was you not only got great food, you got a free meal. But, you know, it's a typical bar, so the kitchen closes.
Right.
So often I was like, I loved, they had this macaroni and cheese that they would bake in like, you know, like a clay pot kind of deal.
Right.
Like one of those.
Oh,
I fucking love that thing. I'd fuck that thing up.
I remember that. Yeah. Oh, God.
I'd fuck it up daily if I could. You know, big shells, big fat shells. And I would always try to find this balance between playing there and eating that thing. And I don't think I ever succeeded, you know, because I'd eat too much. Then I'd have to find his bathroom that, you know, you can't use. And whatever. We won't get into that. But no, Maxwell's was a fun place to be. I appreciate Neil coming on and giving us his insights from the professor.
So who we got next, man?
Well, all right. So thanks to Neil, first off. Next up, we have what I now deem the punk rock Willie Nelson, right? Because
quite a title.
I met, listen, we talk about it a little bit in here. I met Roger Harvey randomly. I went to Kate Hiltz's house in Asbury Park. I'm not sure what I was doing there. And it was just kind of a, you know, skinny, long-haired fella with a very, very mellow vibe, just chilling out. Kate tells me who this is. And like I said in the interview, quickly, I was like, all right, I kind of want to be around this dude. Like, this is a vibe. This is a thing. And then the more and more I got to know about him, his music, the longer he, you know, sort of honed in on exactly what his, you know, solo career was going to be. And now he's just got this really great thing going on. It's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to him, because I find him really soothing and eternally optimistic. And, you know, we come from a world where I think a lot of people are taught to sort of hone in on the darkness a little bit, and sort taught to kind of feed themselves off the darkness. So when I see someone from our ilk, you know, taking this left turn and, you know, trying to come from a spirit of like we talked about, somebody like Willie Nelson, you know, and then put together the family experience, you know, online thing of all the friends and like-minded musicians, and really building kind of a positive community. So I thought Roger would be a good guy to talk to, you know, see how we can get through this next year without keeping our faces in the mud, Brad.
Sounds good to me. Let's check it out.
Yeah, let's check it out. Roger, what's your favorite holiday dessert treat?
Well, you know, I'm vegan.
Okay.
So I feel like I'm
peanut chews?
Yeah. and I live in Philly, so peanut chews.
Yeah, so peanut chews.
I don't know. I had a pecan pie this year. That was like a big, but that doesn't fit in that category.
What would Kate Hilt feed you?
Definitely peanut chews.
Yeah.
and then some weird things from like Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Germany does a really good job with like the vegan sweets. And she's always, you know, I know you know, or I assume you know, because I, you know, I met you at Kate's house that one.
Yeah. I was going to bring, so that is the single solitary time we hung out, right?
In my memory.
Yeah. And it was just a random encounter. Were we both just not there the same day? Just saying hello?
I think we were just kicking it. And yeah. Then, yeah, we smoked a little. And
that's right. Because I remember getting there. I completely don't remember the context. But I remember after about 10 minutes being like, yeah, I chill with this guy.
I remember, like, I know, like, Tim Barry always speaks so highly of you. So
no.
I think it was one of those situations where I guess this might happen a lot at Kate's house, where there's, I'm like, oh, who's this? And then, like, pretty quickly I was like, oh, this is the mutual friend of all these other really important people to me. So
it's the point of Little Eden, isn't it?
It is, right? It's like the community. You know, in Philly, the Tasty has become kind of that similar spirit. Now that Kate spends most of her time there,
right.
It's been a little bit different lately, but she just works her ass off. So, and now, of course, you don't go inside anywhere anymore. So it's a little different, but
she sorted us out. This is the noble and prestigious Kate Hiltz, who was featured on the podcast just 6 weeks, 2 months ago.
Yeah, not too far back.
And she hooked me up because I had a birthday fairly recently. And one of the first things that really started bringing me to Kate's house was her vegan ribs. Which I'm sure you've had before, the barbecue, ribs, the very famous ones. And she would, you know, text me for her, even pre-texting, call me for, you know, these parties and stuff. And I'd say, listen, I'd love to come, but are there going to be ribs? You know, this was like kind of my caveat. And one of the mornings around my birthday, my wife, you know, I like to know what's going on. So she's like, can you do me a favor? Just get in the fucking car without asking like a bunch of questions. I'm like, sure. And she brings me in. I quickly realize we're going to Philadelphia. And I'm like, uh-oh, this has to do with the Tasty. Something has to do with the Tasty. And it turns out I never even saw Kate. But what was waiting for me there? Two trays, full trays of ribs.
Amazing.
This brings me to what I was going to say. We should all just say WWKHD, right? For 2021. What would Kate Hiltz do? Our spirit animal. So how's it going for you? Where are you at? In Philly?
Yeah, I'm sitting here in Philly where I've been sitting for seems like an eternity.
Yeah, and it's been a little bit.
Yeah, but I actually live really close to the Tasty. So here in South Philly, and I don't do shit. I probably don't know, but I work as a bartender when I'm not on tour.
Oh, okay.
And so I ended up at the beginning of this, I flew out to Los Angeles to do some shows with my partner, Anika, who I think has been on the show before.
Maybe like she has,
a long time ago. Yeah.
Yep.
And we basically started our descent into Los Angeles. And when we started our descent, I had paid for Wi-Fi. And I was looking at Twitter and I was like,
okay.
And I saw a tweet. I saw like news come in and it was Tom Hanks. In my memory, it was first, it was Tom Hanks. They were like, we are going to start our slow descent into Los Angeles. And then it was the NBA. And by the time we landed, I was like, did the world just end? Like, did this just all happen like in this like descent? And by the time we landed,
that was like March 10th, March 11th ish.
I think it was the 11th of March.
Yeah.
Maybe the 12th. But yeah, somewhere around there. And by the time we landed, I was like, we've got to cancel all these shows. It just was like very apparent. I saw someone said, what a year the last hour has been. And it was that where I was like, okay, it's not just me. I'm not like, you know, catastrophizing. Like it's really, it was like just kind of the moment. And so, we ended up trying to figure out what to do. And we drove all the way back across the country, which was such a trip and a really long story because it was just so different. Well, I guess now in hindsight, if you drove across America right now, it would probably look really similar in the fact that it was like every town we went to, it was like some towns, it was like ghost town, like lockdown. Right. Other towns, it was like everybody's just going about their business. So
now that you mention this, I think we heard the other side of this story from Jeff Rosenstock the last time he was on. Was he part of accepting you guys in California?
He was part of it because Jeff, we landed and I was like in full on spin of like, we got to cancel these shows, right?
Yeah.
Like, right. You know, and he kind of like, we're kind of like, well, I don't know. Cause a lot of the shows we were doing were house shows on the way to South by Southwest. And at that time it seemed like, well, it's just South by Southwest had been canceled, which obviously was like, that makes a lot of sense. It's this big international festival. Everything was happening in Italy that we had been hearing about. And I was actually with Tim Berry in Philly. We were playing a show and it was like during soundcheck, we got the news that South by Southwest had been canceled. And we were just kind of all like looking at each other like, what the fuck is that? Ended up being the last show that we were able to play at Boot and Saddle, which is now closed. God, it's been a long year.
And in your industry, right?
So we ended up going out to eat with Jeff and we were just like, what do we do? And it was actually really funny because I mean, none of us had any idea what was really ahead of us, but
sure, yeah.
We were just kind of going back and forth at the table. Like, I remember at one point Jeff was like, I'd do the tour. And then we were like, no, we got to cancel the show. Like, we just kept going back and forth. And by the morning it was like, we know what to do.
Yeah. It was so hard to know at that point. It really was. And there was obviously not some sort of, you know, top down, you know, authoritative answer coming from anyone. Cause nobody knew. I mean,
well, there's no precedent.
Yeah. I mean, that's the reason I was dipping like my groceries in hot water for like fucking 3 months. I didn't fucking know, you know, we're doing what we can out here, you know, but so the point of this episode, Roger, and one of the reasons I had you on is because I find you to be a very calming, optimistic character in this world. You present a good feeling to the community you're in, where I think I even said to Jamie, you're kind of reminding me of like the punk rock Willie Nelson. I don't know if you've heard that before. It's probably not too clever. Well,
that's an honor. and you probably know that I'm a huge Willie Nelson fan. And I've learned a lot from listening to Willie Nelson and also his like philosophies on life and stuff have been hugely influential on me.
It's awesome.
So
that being said, you know, we're trying to, I don't think we named this episode. What could we call it? The Optimist Club? Like that Sticks and Stones record? I don't know. But so what's something in the last year? Like, you know, obviously it's been a shit show, but there's anything, you know, personally on the inside of you or in the outside of your community, like, do you think it's been responsible for any positive changes you've seen in your life, your mentality, your community, like anything that it pivoted in a good way for you?
I think it's been, you know, I knew the theme of the show going into it and I was thinking about it a lot. And part of me was like, wow, it's been such an insane year. And it's so important to me to stay optimistic. I think part of that is just being an artist, especially in the way that I operate. It's like, if you can't roll with the punches of everything, there's really no future point. So I've had to just kind of adapt a lot in that sense. But I was talking with someone this morning and I was saying like, I'm having such a difficult time starting this new year. Like usually when we click over, it's like, you know, there's a big celebration and then we're like, all right, these are our resolutions, but it feels different right now. Right. Like, is it just me?
Yeah. No, it does. It
feels more to me like I'm still like kind of reckoning with the last year and trying to wrap my head around it and everything that we've been through. But to go back to the question, at the beginning, I guess I say it's a roller coaster because there's been so many positive things that have come out of this year. And I know that I'm very lucky to be able to say that and feel that way through all the hardship and everything. But the first thing that really struck me was the stillness that we all got to experience. Right. And it was something that I really love and really appreciate. Sure. And when, you know, before a lot of the unrest and I mean, there's such a positive to a lot of the really hard things that have happened too. I think we all know that like the things that have been illuminated about the failures of our country, though they're so difficult, we weren't reckoning with them before. So, you know, talking to someone like my dad about racism in our country, or another thing that I thought was like a little cliche, but like really ironic with the way that I grew up, the conversations about Christopher Columbus and the truth about our history and what it like, you know, that's a huge positive thing that came out of all of this unaddressed darkness.
So like you get back home to Philly and you know, you're someone who works at bars, plays shows, you know, does a J with people at night. Like obviously everything that you have built around Philly is based on, you know, this version of community. So that was quickly replaced with what? Just like a quietness and a stillness that you appreciated, even though that stuff went away.
Truthfully, when we got back, because the drive across the country was beautiful in many ways, and I was so grateful to be able to do it with Anika, it was also very scary. We were like, right, what's happening? What's going to happen when we get back to town? It was just such a chaotic moment. I kept saying when we were on our way back, I kept saying, we should write a book about this sometime. But shortly after that, I realized that no matter where you were in those days, you know, the middle of March, you know, until we entered lockdown in most places, I think at the end of March, you probably feel that way. It's just a moment that we're never gonna forget. And it was so unknown and so unique. But by the time we got back to Philly, it was just like, I remember dropping off the rental car and being like, okay, now we just go to the house.
Right.
And we're just gonna be in the house. And we were really pretty relieved. We stocked up on a bunch of groceries on the way back, and it just went from, like everyone else, it was just everything was just turned upside down. And I feel like I always talk about this. I feel like there was this, you know, speaking of the roller coaster that it's all been, when you're trying to look at all those bright spots, which again there are many, it's like there was a moment in the beginning where we were all like, I have no idea what's going on. What is this show? Tiger King. We'll all watch Tiger King.
Oh,
and I always like think about this like funny moment before all the unrest and all this other stuff happened, where we were all just kind of like, I started doing a show every day, because in my mind I was like, it wasn't like a big elaborate thing. I was just like, well, I have a phone so I can just go live, and I would play a few songs every day. And there was a bunch of really good people that would tune in, and we were all kind of just like, you know, finding this space for this weird moment. And that's like another really funny like relic, because at that time I thought like, all right, I'll do like a show every day for a couple weeks. Then it was like, all right, for a month, I'll do a show. It got to like towards the end of the second month, and I was like, I can't do a show every day anymore. Right, like,
what the hell else am I going to play?
I've played all my songs. I've played so, you know.
I think there was that window right at first where everybody thought we were just kind of like biding time, you know, like, oh, we're biding time till it gets like warm.
Right.
You know, we're biding time until the spring, and then we'll have a better sense of things. We're biding time. And then after, you know, by, I think like, you know, midsummer or something, it just, everybody's like, oh, this is permanent. You know, anybody without their heads and their asses realized like the super major changes that are happening. And I think, I don't know, to me, it went from sort of, like you said, you know, let's drink an extra bottle of wine a week and watch Tiger King, to like, oh, we're on the precipice of like major worldwide change. To me, I think it felt so much more real after, you know, George Floyd and the protests and Black Lives Matter, where like that kind of added to just this dystopian idea that it was kind of like all falling apart. I think before then, maybe we were just so focused on this idea that we're all just going to wait it out and go back to normal, or what we imagined was normal. And then maybe after 2-3 months, normal was no longer an option, you know, like going back to zero was no longer an option. And everyone was almost forced to, to do the things that I think we all had to do, which is like look inside or look outside or look into these different directions to find your own solace inside of it. So that being said, like, do you agree with that? And what did you use once you realized this is like, oh, okay, this isn't going anywhere. And like, how can I save my optimism? How can I save my heart here?
I 100% agree. And you know, I think there's always been the idea that like we all are experiencing this moment together. But it's really interesting to hear you say that because it's exactly the way that I experienced it. When we started, one thing that was bringing me a lot of hope in the beginning and still bringing me a lot of hope, is I've been learning to record from home. And one of the first songs that I did was a song that I was working on. It's called Last Prisoner.
Okay.
I have yet to release it. But I did this recording project for it, for a project called the Last Prisoner Project, which works to help get people who are serving time for cannabis, nonviolent cannabis offenses, predominantly out of prison now that the world is changing so much outside of the prison walls. Sure. And I wrote this song about it and we started recording it. It must have been in April at some time, maybe end of April.
Okay.
And we just wrapped this recording project. We were listening back to it. We had, I'll just say it, even I haven't released it because there are no rules anymore.
No rules.
But one of the coolest things about it is we had Mickey Raphael, who is Willie Nelson's harmonica player,
oh,
in on
fuck
it.
Yeah.
Nice.
Hell yeah.
And that was just such a trip because I'm such a huge fan and he's like a hero of mine. But you know, riding the wave off of that, me and my friend Justin Francis, who I do my recording with down in Nashville, we were just passing things back and forth. He was teaching me. He was like literally like so rudimentary, like, all right, put the microphone here and then play the guitar. And we had just gotten the song back. We were all super excited about it. I was like, it kind of like gave me this feeling like, oh, maybe we could do like a whole record from the house. Like it will be different, but it could be really cool. And it was just super fun.
Yeah.
And then the news of George Floyd came out. And I just felt completely derailed by, you know, I felt so many different things, but it was just like glued to the news. I feel like for like months, you know, and the chaos that followed. And on my birthday is when Donald Trump gave the speech, the famous speech where he walked to the church for the photo op. And I was just like, I was so deep in my head. I couldn't think of it. It was almost like I lost all hope. And I hate feeling that way. But
a song you had written that had such a good intention and a hopeful intention, you just couldn't even, you kind of couldn't face anymore.
No, it wasn't about the song in particular. It was deeper than that. And, you know, I don't want to sound too, but I guess like in that moment, especially at first, it just, we were kind of ramping up to, you know, we'd finished it. We were like, let's get this thing out as soon as possible. And then it was just like, I don't know if I can release music right now.
Yeah.
It just didn't feel like, I just felt like I needed to pay attention and I needed to sit back and I needed to just take this moment in and do anything that I could to help and to understand.
Yeah.
And
so it more the idea of like being seen as you're like trying to promote something in that time?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a huge part of it. Like no matter what spiritual path you are on in music, there's always this kind of thing where that just like lives in my head where I'm just like, I don't want it to seem like I'm like peddling something around. Like I just like to like to make music and I like to do these things. And I try to do a good job and also have, you know, a realistic amount of humility about the yeah. hilarity of all of it.
Sure.
But yeah, I guess more so the story is to exemplify, like, that was, I guess, just to relate to you in that sense where it was just like when the unrest started and George Floyd was murdered and all these things were happening and our, I don't even want to say the word president, because I literally loathe this guy. I oh, hate yeah. him. And I hate that I feel that way even, but there's a lot to hate. Yeah. And he causes so much pain and so much suffering for others. But it took, I guess I was just relating in the sense that it took me a long time to kind of get back. And now I just feel like I'm back to this place where it's like, okay, I've like lined up some things for this year. And it's like, this is the work that I'm going to do. But one of the things that was a big thing for me before this was, I guess to use the word spiritual, was about like, I do approach a lot of things in my life spiritually, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. But music is something that is just so deeply important to me.
Right.
And it's something that I just take so seriously and I love it so much. And I feel so grateful to be able to contribute to in like my little way to this bigger thing that is American music or folk music or whatever it all is. But it's just something that has always given me hope in my life, always kept me going. Yeah. And despite all the hardships of everything. And one thing that really cracked the code for me before this was not playing by all the rules that I was told for so long, especially as a slightly younger person coming up in all of it. You know, there's people out there, I know you know, that say you got to do X, Y, Z, and that mm-hmm. will get you to this place. And none mm-hmm. of that shit ever worked for me. But, yeah. And some of those same people, and maybe this was a little more about me, but I started to feel like maybe I'm not like cut out for this. Maybe this is, but when I finally cracked the code on moving forward with it, it was just kind of like a back to basics moment where I just had to ask myself, what is it? Why do I make music? Right. What is it that I want?
Yeah. And that's right.
And the answer was so simple, or the answers were so simple. And I guess some of those answers are because music saved my life, because I have a spiritual relationship with it. Because when I listen to someone sing a song that moves me, it's the most profound experience that I've had. And it's lifted me out of so much darkness in my life. But
sure.
I think my new, to apply that to, I guess I felt like I had a pretty good stride going, before this. I was traveling a lot. I was playing a lot. I was playing with a lot of really good people. All people that I really like just related to. And
yeah,
it just felt really like family. And I think for me, at least, like music should feel.
Sure.
And, you know, and I was working a lot so that I didn't have to deal with some of the bullshit. right. When you're chasing other things, yeah. you don't have to work right. for. So, but I came, you know, I had a lot of peace with my work at the bar too. I actually quit drinking almost 2 years ago.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
But thank you. But I've been, you know, I've always worked as a bartender and that was a huge part of it. But there's things about bartending that, you know, can eat at me and things like that. But I love the people that I worked for. And I just had like, you know, I was like working at the bar. Then I'd go out on the weekends and play shows. This year, I just started a Patreon, which I know you guys have too, right?
Yeah.
And I've been trying to wrap my head around it. One of the things, like a lot of it makes me really excited because it just seems like a good place to focus my energy. in this new year when we still have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you talk about that point. I mean, I saw a lot of artists go through that, and I guess I went through it myself, you know, was something about what was happening in the country, I think, made everybody turn inside on like their own values. And, you know, if you're just somebody who's on social media every day, just kind of generally just like talking shit, not really like promoting anything, just kind of maybe promoting yourself and talking some shit, all of a sudden the world got real serious around you and there's no place for that. There's no value to that. And I think a lot of people were able to look inside of themselves at that point and determine their own value. And the fact that, you know, you had to step back, see what your music meant to you, the fact that it holds this much value to you, and what, and then you feel comfortable putting it out into the world again. So I think everybody had this sort of stark contrast of like, is the thing I'm doing valuable enough to even have a space right now? And if it's not, maybe I should just shut the fuck up, right? So how did that turn into you? Like for you, the, you know, you talk a lot about creating the family and having, you had your family show just a couple weeks ago, right?
I did.
So have you been able to take that feeling you got after that and turn it into, you know, more of an effort or an avenue that like you'd like to see it go down more in like 2021?
I think my favorite part of music, or one of my favorite parts of music, is that community aspect. I think it's so interesting that as artists, we have this like incredible privilege to meet so many different people who all do incredible things, and we get to choose, not like we're going out there like I choose you and I don't choose you, but right, you know, you vibe with people and
sure.
There's just people. I mean, Tim Berry is a great example of someone that we have done so much touring together. And from the first time we went out, it was just, I didn't know Tim that well when we started traveling. But I had a feeling. I have so much respect for him. And I mean, he's Tim. He's an amazing human and songwriter. But, you know, you just have those, I think we all have those experiences where we're just really lucky to meet other people who are just like, yeah, you get it. Like we get it. We're, and that's what, to me, the family show at its essence is about. It's about people who I've been lucky enough to meet and who I just think are exceptional people in my little corner of things. And the holiday show that we just did,
yeah,
I have no idea how we pulled it off, but I'm really grateful for the little role that I could play in it and for everyone that participated, because it really was like, it was the highlight of my year. Because I guess I'm realizing now, because of that, because it is this, it exemplifies the power of a union of people, good people coming together. No music market, no music business, just like me in my house, who I don't have any access to a lot of those avenues, texting friends of mine saying, hey, would you sing a song for this show? And then and then pulling something together that got a crazy amount of viewership, and because of all the amazing people involved, and I don't know, brought me a lot of hope. And I know at least a few people told me that they felt the same about it. So it was a huge accomplishment.
Well, good, man. You're a steward of positivity. We need it.
We're trying.
So, I mean, so you wake up, you know, you wake up there in the day, or I don't know when you wake up, in the morning. What's something like you'll tell yourself on a daily basis to kind of to stay positive, to stay connected, What are some tools that you use to stay optimistic? Besides for weed.
Well, yeah, that's a big one. That's definitely also like music has saved my life. I don't know. I do think that there's something in this idea of stillness. I was talking to Tom May last night. I had this philosophy that was based on my friend Mike Brenner, who plays steel guitar with me, who is just a legend in his own right, and someone that when I walk into the room with him, I feel like his presence really pushes me because I have such a deep respect for his musicianship and his legacy. And I can't, every time I play with him, I'm like, I can't believe that he will play with me. And so we were on our way up to New York City for a show. I did a show where I played acoustic guitar with the band Wild Pink.
Okay.
And Mike plays in that band as well. And we were just kind of rapping about this stuff. We were talking about our philosophy of music and life. And he said something that I thought was really profound. He said that, you know, for all the hardship of music, the one thing that always keeps me going is striving for excellence. And I just thought it just really hit me because,
cool. Very cool.
Because it's such a cool philosophy, but it's also, something that when I stand on stage with him, I look over at him or when I watch him play with someone else and I'm like, that's excellence. He's striving for excellence. It's so good. Yeah. So I just had such a deep respect for it. It really like got in my mind. I was sharing it with some friends of mine because I thought it was just so inspiring. And yesterday I was talking to Tom and he said, you remember how 2020 was all about excellence when we started? And we were like laughing about it. And he said, 2021 is all about ease. And I was like, I just said, I love it. I think that like something in the stillness and just allowing, you know, there's so much like hustle in this world and in every aspect of this world. And right now, many of us, though, there are a lot of hardships. And I guess like one complicated part is it is in a different point now where it's like, well, what are we going to do? For me, I was lucky to get unemployment. And we're like, how long is that going to last? But I'm just going to try to take things one day at a time. And I think ease is the word that I would say that I think I'm going to try to focus on this year as I get in the flow of everything.
Perfect word for 2021. And so, I mean, that's kind of the philosophical side. Is there a sort of physical, tangible side that you use? Like, do you carve space in every day to think, to walk, to meditate? Like, is there anything in your daily practice that you find helps?
Well, so many things. But the weed, I mean, I smoke a lot of, I take in a lot of weed. It's like medicine to me. I do feel like it has a tendency to, you know, we're deep thinkers because of it. It's something that I identified about smoking from the first time that I did it. It's just an elevated kind of thought process and a lot of problem solving. And I love that. One thing about this past year that I'm so grateful for is I've been playing so much guitar. It's something that I never have time or struggle to find time, especially when we're in the swing of like doing a lot of shows and stuff like that. Sometimes you can like lose that aspect, but I can't say that this year that there hasn't been an abundance of time to just sit around with my guitar. And I've been writing a lot. I've had a lot of lulls this year where it's kind of like, how do you write? What do you write about in this? Am I ready to write about this? You know, as we like process it all in real time, but I've been really proud of a lot of the songs that I've gotten out. And we also got a puppy
COVID puppy.
Yeah.
Just like so many others, that it's like such a great, it was such a great year to be a dog rolling
What's
into
its name?
Another
19.
It's the last hope. It's her name is Sister Bobby, and she's named after Willie Nelson's sister. But we call her sister. We call her sister for short. And
I just saw that book in Barnes and Noble that they wrote the memoir to each other.
Yeah, I'm actually reading it right now.
Yeah, it seemed really interesting. What a cool connection those two have.
It's such a cool format, the way that the book works, because it's chapter for chapter and it's pretty short form, but they basically tell the same stories just from their perspective, which is very different because they different age. And it's not just the Willie Nelson story, not to discredit the focus here of Sister Bobby, but I love reading that stuff. Greg from the Souls gave me he was like, you have to read this book. And he sent me a copy of Willie Nelson's last memoir. It's called It's a Long Story, My Life. And I just was endlessly inspired by it. But it's not just about the story. It's the way that he tells it and the philosophy behind all of it. But that I'm just getting into that book, but it's, same spirit there.
Yeah. I love that. Well, I've been asking the question, what's a book or a film that you would recommend? So we'll go with that one. But since you have such a deep understanding of Willie, or I think you have a deep understanding of Willie, at least deeper than me, what do you think is a nugget that Willie Nelson would want to tell the world right now? Like, what's the true intention of his work? Like, if you could just simplify it.
I think, firstly, he's been doing a lot of interviews and telling people but I think that the thing that really hit me, and the reason, the conversation that kind of stemmed why Greg was like, you have to read this book, is for me, the big inspiration that I connected to is the ability to let things go, which is a philosophy that is so deeply important to me. But I think the true beauty of the Willie Nelson story is about hope, and it's about positivity, and it's about humility, and it's about continuing through all the hardships. And I just think it's a truly beautiful thing to see someone who does something similar to what I do, which is sing songs, and has been through all this bullshit on his level, which is so different than mine, but I really related to a lot of the stories, and to go through it all and to be where he's at today and still doing what he's doing. I think about it sometimes and I'm like, man, if I can be 87 and doing what he's doing, I'll be pretty happy with everything, especially
right
if
there,
I can be so spiritually at peace about all the hardships of that everything in life brings.
Let's be like Willie, huh?
Let's all just be like Willie. We'll burn one and we'll get through this.
All right, Brad, you ready for that? Double blunts? Double blunt session? Can you do it?
It could be some long pauses in that session.
Nah, if you keep, there's a reason the hippie speedball is called the hippie speedball. If we keep enough coffee in tow, we should be all right, you know? What would happen to you? It's a serious question, okay? Say we were recording at like the podcast network we were recording at before the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to drop the name anymore. clearly not listening. So say we're in that studio, right? Pretty small,
mm-hmm.
You know, pretty airtight. Mm-hmm. And let's say, Roger, we're not coming in with bangers. You know, they called them Gotties when I was a kid. When I was a kid, if you smoked a Gotti, you didn't even crack the blunt open. You just picked the tobacco out of it and left the shell.
Right.
And actually filled that with weed. I don't know if you can imagine how much weed that takes.
It's a lot of weed.
To fill a lot. Okay. So say we're not doing Gotties, but we have some sizable ones. Mm. Like, do you think you're going along for the ride with us there?
I don't think I'll have a choice, dude. It's called a contact high.
How long has it been since it's touched your lips?
Weed?
Yeah.
Oh, I think I hit a joint at a Christmas party. I mean, I did. I think maybe last year.
Okay, so about
but
a year
I don't
ago.
Do it very often. I mean, I've said this, maybe not on the show, but like, you know, it's too powerful. I'll be psyched when they make it legal in New York State so that I can go get like, you know, like a high CBD concentrate, like low THC mix, like the fucking garbage weed that I smoked when I was 14, you know. Like, right. It's too strong for me. I used to, when I was doing more like producing and stuff, I worked with an artist who I won't name, but this guy had a West Coast connection that at the time was the most powerful weed you could get in New York. I'm not even joking. Like, he got on a lot of, I'm gonna end up IDing if I talk too much. Put it this way, when Sean Paul came to town, I've had dinner with Sean Paul because he would come from Jamaica and get weed from this dude when he was in New York. So
this was Sean Paul's New York weed hookup. The guy who had a song.
Yes. That's how chronic.
Give me the light and pass the dro. Okay. Yes. So yeah, that's some high level
stuff.
This stuff
was so chronic. And there was one time I remember, so I've got a lot of contact highs around him. I did a bunch of music with him. And it was usually all with lots of weed going on.
That reminds me of, have you ever heard that famous like wives tale? I'm not sure if it's real or not, but there is a story that, you know, there's a part in I Shot the Sheriff, the original version of it, where you can hear like a skip.
Okay.
And it became a mythology that I've heard from more than one person. That apparently the crew left the studio. They were just wrapping up like a song or an album. So the producer, apparently, who didn't smoke, picked up something that was in an ashtray to like, you know, reward themselves for finishing the session. This is in the days of tape.
Right.
And apparently was smoking it. The cherry fell out and burnt through a portion of the 2-inch tape. And before they got back, you know, he like stone panicked
and spliced it together.
And apparently you can hear that jump in the song.
Oh, my God.
So I would love if anyone listening can.
I would fully believe it.
Nor deny this tale.
As somebody who has been in enough similar sessions where shit like that happened, I fully believe that story. That doesn't even like. Sound far-fetched to me at all.
So this is where I'm like, man, I just didn't make it big enough in music, you know? Because I'm like, I've been to studios, I've recorded on 2-inch tape, and you know what? Every single time I did, I would have gotten thrown out of that fucking recording room if I brought a blunt into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I never had enough juice where I could just walk around a studio with a blunt. I was a drummer subjugated to the weird weed room and whatever it was in the studio, you know?
Speaking of weed, who do we have next?
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's the perfect premise for getting into my Aunt Judy, who I hope listens. She knows. They all know. I don't care. I think, who knows? She's a psychologist in New York for many years.
She's
I'm sure she's
got to
no
be pretty cool.
No stranger to these things, but definitely cool enough where I certainly have no hesitancy for my aunt to hear the fact that I've smoked blunts in recording studios. I'm pretty sure my family wouldn't be super shocked about that. But anyway, speaking of spirit animals, my Aunt Judy's not only been a source of, you know, inspiration and spirit for just me, but my entire family. She's not only a psychologist, she's funny as fuck, super giving, super generous, and also a really talented artist. You know, like every year for my entire life, I've gotten handmade collage birthday cards, holiday mm-hmm. cards, these beautiful, like they're all like little pieces of art to the point that my father has them framed in his bathroom. And I'm not the only one who get them. We all get them.
Mm.
We all get these beautifully thought out collaged cards. Just one of those people is so thoughtful and so consistent and has always been this great beacon in my life for sure. And you know, by knowing her, I usually get off the phone when we talk with a new perspective or some new piece of knowledge that I found usable.
Mm.
So I figured that's a perfect person to talk to right now. You know, I might take some shit from my dad that I didn't ask him because he's sitting in Florida probably being like, yo, what the fuck? But we'll get to it, Pops. Don't worry. but yeah, I don't know. And it was really interesting to talk to her. I even there was a couple of times when we were doing this where I'm like, wait, I'm recording I'm interviewing my aunt right now. This is fucking weird. It was a little surreal actually at times. But yeah, that was awesome. We should listen to our Aunt Judy segment. Auntie, you sound better than some audio professionals and singers and stuff that we use. I think your Chromebook is working well.
Well, thank you. I'm very fond of it.
So how's it going? You okay?
Yep. It's been a long day, but everything's okay.
So we're doing this episode. As you know, we're usually doing long form interviews with guitarists and singers and drummers about songwriting process and things like that. But I thought it would be nice to start the year to have a few spirit animals on who guide us through. You are one of my spirit animals. And we wanted to ask you a couple questions about not only like your experience the last year, but just some things we can all learn from and move ahead on going into this new one. So, I mean, first, was there anything in like the last year that you came away thinking that this was like some sort of positive twist or something you saw in like the world or yourself that actually moved it in a good direction?
Well, I think it's hard and you have to dig deep to really find it. But in general, I found that people have been more caring than one anticipated.
Yeah.
And for the most part, much more respectful of other people. So that was kind of a positive. It's sad that it takes a situation like this to bring out those qualities in people, but I did see that. On a personal level, it's interesting that I also overcame a lot of the fear of being alone.
Mm.
And that's always been a challenge, you know.
Right.
You like to be around people, and very often being around people helps you to get away from some of your own thoughts and your own worries and fears. So it was really a confrontation with self over this past year, which I think is really important. I don't know how much I'll take away with me when we go back to normalcy, if we ever do. But I think that was an important quality too. And also to take more time to think and get involved with, as you probably know, I enjoy art and painting and so on. And I really had much more time to do that and really kind of challenge myself in that direction.
Oh, that's
great. This pandemic really tied into, I mean, how long prior to the fall of Rome here did you actually officially retire?
2 years.
Yeah. So I mean, this kind of came all at a head, huh? Like, because you had to deal with not only kind of the loss of community through school, but then on top of that, being a little stuck in the house, right? So it was really like a slap in the face.
Yes, Ben, that's an excellent point because, you know, I was at the point of thinking, okay, now that I'm retired and I really want to continue to contribute, although I still work one day a week and I do a lot of clinical supervision, trying to figure out, do I want to use my skills in a voluntary way or do I want to do something completely different? And everything that I was planning just obviously, like with everybody else, fell apart.
Right. I want, like, you know, you've been working in a, obviously the teaching context for, you know, the bulk of your adult life at this point. And, you know, so many of the things that happened are obviously a result of the world itself and a disease that nobody has control over. But, you know, things were changing prior to this disease. You know, there was a lot of twists and turns for culture already happening. And this, you know, almost feels like the culmination to me. The question I wanted to get at is, like, in your years of seeing and ushering eager young minds through college, is there something in the last few years, a real tangible difference that you could hone in on that's different in the younger generations and perhaps causing problems for the newer generations?
Well, okay. Just for clarity, Benny, you know, most of my work has been with graduate students who are clearly goal-oriented and getting their doctorates in psychology.
Right.
So that's one group, and I'll reflect on that in a minute.
Sure.
But I also made a commitment to teach undergraduates because I like them. And that's where there was a real change in terms of less learning for learning's sake and more learning to achieve an outcome.
I see.
And if something wasn't directly relevant to who they wanted to become, there was very little intrigue in the content. I mean, I was teaching an interdisciplinary course, which, you know, I find exciting with it has poetry and literature and music and and half the students say, why do we have to learn this? You know, I'm going to be an accountant. I don't need to know this.
Yeah, right.
And then there are several individuals who come to college, and right now you probably know the number, but 72% of high school graduates attend some form of higher education.
Right.
And with all due respect, and it doesn't mean they aren't lovely people, I think at least one third to one half of them really need to do something else before they come to college.
Ah, interesting.
And we have so devalued, you know, the trades,
carpenter,
plumber, and you probably have experienced this recently, you know, trying to get someone to do something in your home. And when my electrician drives up in a BMW, you know, and I'm driving my old Toyota, you begin to wonder.
Yeah, right. Maybe the undergrad degree wasn't the best idea.
That's right. What did my doctorate do for me, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's true. I mean, if Zeke came up to me, you know, tomorrow and said, hey, I want to, and maybe not tomorrow, let's give it a few years, but, you know, if he came up to me and was like, yeah, you know, I want to go to this college and just mess around. I'll start in the liberal arts program and, you know, maybe get this kind of degree without that real focus. I think at this point, I would really advise against it, you know, unless there was like, and I know I'm a unique case of someone who managed to, you know, get anywhere without, you know, getting into a corporate structure or getting into the education structure. You know, I managed to make a life for myself without it, but I know that that's rare. And right. And I would. I mean, I see so many people struggling through trying to find their way with degrees when, yeah, like you said, they would have been better off. Hey, you used to tinker with amps when you were 16. You probably should have just went in and been an electrician, like you said.
Right. I mean, it's so interesting. I have very, very bright doctoral student that I'm supervising now. And I said to her, oh, by the way, what does your husband do? And very apologetically, she told me that he was an electrician.
Oh, right. Like you know, this is something to be devalued or something.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And over the years, we've really more and more devalued those craftspeople.
Right.
And who we can't live without, the auto mechanic and the plumber and the electrician and the carpenter. You know, hey, my plumber comes to the house before he even looks at anything. It's $125.
Right. Well, and the thing, yeah, I mean, and even less, well, I don't know if it's less or more than money, but I don't know when that cultural delineation came into a certain type of work, because when I started doing woodworking and furniture making, you know, I quickly realized the truly artistic side of these things. You know, you need to see it, you need to draft it, you need to know the tools, you need to have a million tricks over a course of years to make it actually, you know, look like you see it in your head. And a musician goes through the same exact thing, where like, just because you hear a song in your head does not mean you know how to play it or how to execute it. And it takes, you know, years and years of discipline and practice to know how to do that. And I see a plumber come in and redo a, let's say, even a ventilation system that has some weird cuts and moves in it and gets, you know, gritted up to the wall in a certain way. I look at it, and if it's well done, I see it as art.
That's right. I mean, and you, I'm sure that your dining room table was one of your greatest accomplishments, aside from your children.
Yeah, I mean, but that's classic to the point where it was like, yeah, it was a serious accomplishment then. But now I look at it and I see about 8 errors I know not to make.
Right.
For the next one, because it was my first table, you know?
Right. Absolutely. But I think there's a couple of things that we've really devalued in our society, and that is hand craftsmanship.
Yeah.
Right.
And the other is really broad-based learning or knowledge. You know, anybody could be a good accountant. But who do you go to? I mean, I often have told my students, my accountant is great, but why do I go there? I'm sure he and 100 others could do the same job for me, but he's a nice guy and we have a conversation and right. We talk about interesting things and we don't only talk about how much money I owe.
Right. There's still a human there. Yeah.
Right. And those values, you know, and maybe I'm foolish, Betty, but I'd rather go to a cleaner's that's a little bit more money because she knows my name and she knows how I like my clothes rather than going to the discount place next door.
That's why you go to the Subway on Tuesday night, right? Because they call you the professor.
That's right. Okay, you revealed my deepest.
I revealed it. It was funny you say that, though, because I was just recently watching something in a film where, you know, it was a period film from like the 40s or 50s, and someone was in a house and they were a guest of the house. And after a couple drinks, they started singing and playing piano. And I'm like, you know, how much of, like you said, this lack of like broadband education where maybe people are so singularly focused, like partially is because, you know, when you went to a party in the 1940s, to be an impressive, well-rounded person was to be able to walk in there, hold a conversation, and potentially also have this other skill that could entertain a room, because you weren't watching TV, you weren't listening, you know, to your Spotify, you weren't like somebody there had to entertain you. So there's maybe more of a value in people having this broader set of skills that maybe they don't even like need anymore.
Well, the other piece is that, you know, the difference between being alone and creative versus being lonely. you know, and it has a different set of values to it. I mean, one of the things you can see, for example, Benny, in your nieces, the girls don't watch TV.
Yeah.
They don't, you know, they don't use their computers that much, but they write plays.
Right. Yeah.
And they write songs, and the fairy padaries are still in full operation.
Sure are. Zeke's still trying to get in.
hopefully without becoming transgender, they'll let him in.
Who knows? I don't know. I'm not sure what the rules are. Fairy Padary, the rules to get into the group get stricter and stricter as
right.
the years go on.
Right.
Yeah, it's true, though. So, all right. So you know, we're trying to look into 2021 with some optimism, right. with some ways to shape it. What are some, you know, tools, like actual physical tools or philosophies that you'll be like taking going into the new year? Something you try to take with you or remind yourself daily to keep a good perspective?
You know, I was thinking a little bit about that. And I mean, I'll preface it with saying sometimes I wish I was a psychic rather than a psychologist, so I could predict, you know, some of the things that are going to go on.
Sure.
But I have such mixed feelings. There's an optimistic core that some of the lessons we all learned are going to be carried through.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when you see how people, you know, you take a look at some of the crises like hurricanes and so on, and people working side by side, irrespective of race, creed, and or national origin.
Yeah.
And they're really sharing. And then once the crisis is over, you know, as Dorothy Parker said, they return to tripe, you know, they go back to some of their original patterns of behavior.
Yeah.
But one can only hope, and, you know, I don't want to get too political, but one could only hope with a different kind of role model leading the population, and the person may not be the most dynamic and the most charismatic, but you get the feeling of kindness and caring. And perhaps that will be able to quell some of the anger and some of the discrimination and anti-ism that has been so prevalent in these past 4 years.
Sure, sure.
So that for me, once he gets inaugurated and some of the choices he's made for his cabinet gives me a moment of optimism.
I mean, that's... you know, getting into like the things that we, you know, sort of, we have no control over, right? Like these are our hopes. These are the things we can hope happens, but we really don't have any control. What's something like you wake up in the morning, what's something you go to kind of, even though all these things are happening, something you use to just still get through the day with a smile on your face and remain personally optimistic or hopeful?
I tell myself a joke.
Yeah?
And then I laugh.
Every morning?
Almost every morning. I make them up, and some of them are not very good.
Some singer is better than others? Yeah.
Yeah, some are better than others. You know, also listening, there are certain people who, there are certain programs and certain people who kind of make you laugh. And I think laughter is very important. Mm. And also, you know, thinking about each day, maybe reaching out to somebody who you haven't spoken to in a while.
Yeah.
I mean, I've just rediscovered some old friends in the past couple of months. And it's like, you know, people are seeking these kinds of contacts. And then some of the relationships, because, you know, there isn't that in-person communication, have reached another level of depth in sharing Mm. You know, it's funny, Benny, you know, it used to be you meet with friends, you say, did you eat at a good restaurant? What did you have to eat?
Yeah, right.
Did you see such and such a play? And what did you think of it? And the conversations have shifted to a somewhat different level.
Yeah.
You know, like, what do you say when you talk to somebody? So how do you feel? You feel okay? But so the conversation gets somewhat more, with certain people anyway, a little bit more personal, a little bit more philosophical, learning more about people I've known for years because of those conversations.
That's awesome. That's interesting. I like that.
I think it's positive. I'm also seeing it from a more professional side. And for some people, and I've been talking to, you know, colleagues as well, some people working with their therapists or mental health providers, not being in the same room, it has been a positive experience. One case that I've been supervising for, I say, 3 or 4 years with different therapists, in this past year, I think this man has made more gains not sharing a space with his therapist, but they Zoom. He sits in his car and they Zoom, but he's in his own space.
Right.
And he's much more reflective and open. So it's had some very, very interesting consequences. What's going to be the outcome and how people are going to transition back to having the in-person connections will be very interesting to observe.
Yeah. And you said at the beginning of that, there's a couple people that you kind of lean to that make you laugh, give you that perspective. Is there any like books or films or podcasts or something that you would recommend?
Well, I don't know if it's universal, but on public radio, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Okay.
With Peter Sagal, which is wonderful. And, you know, that's kind of a punny, funny, news relevant program, which is really good. You know, it's just, Benny, I think it's random.
Just whatever gets you that day.
Yeah.
All right. Now, just to end it on a fun note, and we've been asking a couple people this, we talked about it before. We're talking about the most memorable New Year's Eve experience that you've had.
I have two.
Okay.
Is it okay if I share two?
Please.
Okay. The first one, took place, we were in Cuba,
mm-hmm.
and we it was New Year's Eve.
You and Uncle Shell?
Yeah. Okay. We were on, it was at the time, you couldn't go on your own. You went on a tour, and we went with Inside Cuba. And the celebration was in Cathedral Square in Havana,
mm-hmm.
with long tables and lots of mojitos and great music. And in the middle of the dinner, there was a huge cloudburst. And about 1,000 people, all well-dressed, we all crawled under the tables while the rain came down. The minute the rain stopped, everybody got up, dried off their seats, got more mojitos, and went on with the celebration.
Oh, that's so good.
And nice. that was amazing. The other one, Uncle Shell and I were in Maui in Hana, in Heavenly Hana, for New Year's Eve, which is like at the tip of Maui and nowhere. And we discovered that there was this, quote, hotel that was having a New Year's Eve celebration. So we made reservations, and it started like at 7 o'clock. And it was typically Hawaiian food, some of which is good, some of which isn't. And we were serenaded by a ukulele band, which was composed of the bus driver and the dishwasher and the waitress. At 10 o'clock, they rang bells and said, "Okay, everybody go home. New Year's Eve is over." So New Year's Eve ended at 10 o'clock so everybody could go home and celebrate.
Oh, my God.
So those were two very special New Year's for us.
Those are good ones. What was Uncle Shell doing at parties in the 60s, 70s? Was he a ripper? Was he really, could you put him back? Or was, no?
Not so much. Benny, that's funny. That's going to make me laugh tomorrow morning.
We'll do a podcast with Uncle Shell next. We'll just make sure to leave a lot of time and have him put the volume way up.
Right. And he moves slowly. Once I could get him someplace, he's great.
Yeah.
Until we get there, there's a whole other story.
Oh, I love it. Hey, Brad, what do you got?
I'm just enjoying the ride here. This is great. Okay.
This is me and my aunt. We could talk all day. I really appreciate you coming on. I'm so glad I got to interview my Aunt Judy on a podcast. This is fucking awesome. Yeah.
I find it awesome also. This is my highlight of the week.
Oh, good. Yeah, life has come around in some strange ways, huh?
Right. It's nice to meet you, Brad. Maybe someday I'll see you.
Oh, I hope so. I do hope so.
Anyway, guys, take care of yourselves. Thank you for the treat. Right. This was fun.
Thanks so much.
Fun for us, too. I love you, Auntie.
Take care. Love you, too, Benny.
Oh, good night, Aunt Judy.
Good night, Aunt Judy. I love it. I gave up her secret that I have to tell the story because it's funny. Yeah, it's funny to me because, you know, she's been away from the city for a while. And I knew last night was the first time she was coming into the city for a while. And I know the way I am, like when I'm on tour or something and I get back home, I'm like, all right, I got to get a slice. I got to get this. I got to get my thing. So I ask her with great certainty that she has something in mind. So I ask the question. I'm like, all right, you're in New York. You don't have Uncle Shell with you for one night. What do you do? Like, what's your I'm thinking like, oh, this diner on 92nd and this, or like, you know, something super New York.
Right.
And she tells me she's going to get a foot long tuna sub from Subway and go to Pinkberry.
Okay.
You know, and I'll spare you all the details of why she wants to do that. But I was just shocked. Out of all the answers I thought I was going to get for a woman who's lived that long in New York City, I was shocked.
Everybody has a dark side, Benny.
I know. What would yours be? Say you were gone randomly for like a couple months and went back to the city for like one night.
Wow. I mean, it would probably be like a slice, you know. I still firmly stand behind the New York City slice as, but there's not really anything, like, I'm trying to think if there's anything that I can't take my family to that I can indulge in. Mm-hmm. Because they've got pretty broad palates, I guess. That's a good question. I'll have to think
about it. What's your slice spot?
I'm a big fan of Williamsburg pizza.
Okay.
I know it's called Williamsburg pizza, but we have one over here on, I think it's actually on Grand Street, on my street further west.
Nice.
I like that. But, you know, I also am a big advocate for any, the closest place, you know what I mean? New York, like, it's hard to go wrong.
Yeah.
Still, which is nice.
Yeah. Sure is. I've been noticing a lot of square pies out there, but...
Oh, really?
Yeah, we won't get into that debate right now. That could go for hours. But I hope people walked away from this episode here. I really hope that my intent for this episode came through and that anybody who just listened to all of these came away with a couple insights or new tools in their toolbox to hit 2021 in a positive and optimistic way. Cause, you know, even my aunt said it, you know, we quickly got into like, oh, if this happens with the politics and if this happens, and there's like,
right,
you know, if there's one thing I've learned about this past year is like, if you're, you know, if you're not out in the fucking streets and you're not doing something and you're not taking this direct action, like you gotta find a way to like live your life and still contribute positively to the world if you can, if the situation lends itself to that. But, you know, you can't do that if you're just too consumed in, you know, your own darkness or vulnerability.
Which is easy to, you know, it's easy to fall into that. So
super easy. Of any of us, I'm sure everybody, most people have seen Soul at this point, you know, you just can't operate when you got all that black gunk on your soul, you know, just can't do it.
No.
So that was my intent with this episode. I hope we were able to provide some insight with some smart, philosophically sound people, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I enjoyed it.
I did too. Regardless, it was fun to catch up with all these people. Roger Harvey is the only one with socials that we interviewed. He's XO Roger Harvey at Twitter and Instagram. Everyone should check him out. Check out his music.
Check out his music for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. My aunt and Neil, you know, you can find them in the ether, go to college, yeah, you know, get an education. Maybe you'll meet them. And then, we have some stuff, right? We have socials. We have our Patreon.
We are going off track where you find your social media, and patreon.com/goingofftrack will get you a little more access to some of our hidden secrets if you're willing to pony up monthly to become a patron and join the team. If not, just go leave us some nice iTunes reviews. Those are free. Or if you want to throw us a little tip, there's always Venmo. Venmo.com at Off Track. We'll take some shekels. And thank you to everybody who's thrown us a few bones over the holidays. We appreciate it. And it'll go to good use.
That's right. And I believe you set up a chat room for us to have a bit of a...
Yeah, we just got to commit to a time.
Powwow with the Patreons where we can...
The patrons will have direct access to us at some point very, very soon.
So we can have a chat, talk about some stuff.
Yeah.
Funny thing happened today. You'll appreciate this. Random guy emails me from Australia saying he's a big fan, and can I buy a pair of your signature sticks? Mm. You want to know what the joke about that is?
You don't have them.
No one ever fucking gave me signature sticks.
No way. That can't be true.
It's true. I had a Promark endorsement. I still do have a Promark endorsement. But years ago, at the height of my powers, I asked about this signature stick, and it was like a pay-to-play thing. I was like, sure, you can have
one.
Just, you know, submit the autograph, and then you basically get your normal, like, rate or something on them.
Really?
And I'm like, how corny is that? Like, God. I'm like, I can't pay for my own signature sticks and design. Like, that's the corniest thing ever.
Yes.
So I never had one.
I'm glad to hear that you didn't take it up.
So just like my Wikipedia... Never had a Wikipedia, never had a signature stick.
Well, you got a Sharpie, don't you?
Listen, 2021, it's about old man Benny Horowitz getting better at promotion. No, it's not. That's what people want me to do, but I don't think I'm going to. I think I'm going to continue on my journey of self-reflection and trying to provide interesting and artistic content to people who want to listen to it.
That's a beautiful thing, Benny.
If I continue on that journey, everything will work out fine, you know?
Yes.
Brad, we didn't sign up for this life to get the gold watch, right?
No, definitely not.
Anyway.
Happy New Year to everybody.
I love you.
Love you too, Benny.
Thanks, buddy. Well, thanks to everyone for listening to the 2021 episode, and
I hope you got something out of it.
We'll be back to old white guys talking about guitars soon enough.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.